This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up today on the program, what the president said and what he really meant. No, we are somehow still not done with the financial crisis and our series, Your Economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. The 21st of January is what my calendar says. It is a Wednesday. Great to have you with us as always. Okay, so here's where we are, going on 24 hours after President Obama's State of the Union last night. The he said, she said has been done. The fact-checking has been done. So maybe a little bit of, wait, what did that mean exactly is in order here. Two-thirds of that speech last night, plus or minus, was built around a theme, what the president called middle-class economics, which sounds appealing, I suppose, if, as I said, you can figure out what it means. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going.
Ask just about anybody, and they'll tell you they're part of the middle class.
Certainly, it is the label of choice.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief of Gallup. He says more than half of the people in their last survey said they were middle class. But there's more to it than just wealth or income.
So middle class seems to be a very comfortable place for Americans to put themselves.
Middle class is so comfy because it's squishy. There's no formal economic definition, so people define it themselves.
And that often means working, not relying on government. But it's really a nebulous concept.
That's Melissa Carney. She heads the Hamilton Project at the Brookings Institution. Carney says politicians love to talk about middle-class Americans, but it's hard to tailor government programs to them, precisely because there's no middle-class definition. Carney says as a result, President Obama's plan bleeds over to not-so-middle-class Americans.
Some of these tax benefits would extend to folks making, couples making $200,000.
Carney is talking about a tax credit for two-earner couples. Other parts of the president's plan mainly apply to low-income Americans, things like increasing the minimum wage and instituting paid sick days. The president's plan would have to be more targeted to reach people truly in the middle of the pack. Did he hit the target?
He threw a water balloon at it, and it splattered all over the place.
Sharon O'Halloran is a professor of political economy at Columbia University.
He saw a target middle class and just made a bunch of big sweeping proposals, which he thought would be appealing to them.
They won't be appealing to Congress, though. Still, O'Halloran says the president has set the stage for Democrats who want to make middle class economics part of the 2016 presidential race. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
We've had sort of a sub-theme going on this program the past couple of weeks that while we are doing all right here economy-wise, the rest of the world, maybe not so much. To that end, tomorrow, the European Central Bank is expected to roll out its version of quantitative easing, the big bond-buying program the U.S. Federal Reserve is just now winding down. Dan Bobkoff has the European nuts and bolts.
Europe could use some help. Inflation is below zero, unemployment is high, and growth is low.
I think QE is very badly needed in the Eurozone.
Jonathan Loins is chief European economist at Capital Economics. He says Europe is teetering on the brink of recession. For years, ECB head Mario Draghi has been telling the markets he'll do whatever it takes. Now, it's time to do something.
The big question, though, is how big is it going to be? What form is it going to take? And just how effective could it be in terms of reviving the Eurozone economy?
Experts expect the ECB will announce at least a 500 billion euro bond buying program tomorrow, hoping private investors use the proceeds to invest elsewhere in the economy. Christian Scholz is senior economist at Berenberg Bank, and he says QE can have many effects.
It can lower interest rates, it can increase credit demand, it can increase credit supply, it can lower the exchange rate.
But despite all that, many in Europe, especially in Germany, are not on board. QE increases the money supply, and Germans have bad memories of 1920s hyperinflation, says Quincy Crosby of Prudential Financial.
Central Bank of Germany at the time literally printed money, and Germans went to buy a loaf of bread with baskets of money.
And Germans have a more immediate fear. If QE works, it could take the pressure off the Eurozone's weaker members to fundamentally change how they do things.
In other words, they say, we still need to see structural reform. We need to see budgets being balanced. We need to see austerity measures.
But markets already expect a sizable QE package. So if Draghi's plan falls short, it could make things in Europe even worse. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
If you'll forgive the tortured metaphors here for a second, the long tail of the financial crisis reared its ugly head today. The Securities and Exchange Commission came down hard-ish on the ratings agency Standard & Poor's over its misleading ratings of commercial mortgage-backed securities during the crisis. Fines will total almost $80 million, and S&P was banned from rating a good-sized chunk of the mortgage market for a year. It is, to be sure, the first action against a ratings firm and is a blow to S&P, but it's also an opportunity for that company's competition, especially the smallest ratings agency, Fitch. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
The suspension will bar S&P from rating securities backed by bundles of loans tied to everything from shopping malls to office buildings. And the ban is significant because investors typically require these kinds of bonds to be graded by two of the three ratings agencies. And now that S&P is riding the pine, well, you do the math.
So who do they go to? They have to now sort of go to Moody's and Fitch.
Amitosh Purnanandam is a professor of finance at the University of Michigan. He says the long-term impact of the ban may extend well beyond a year. That's because lots of sensitive information is shared with ratings agencies.
So once you as a potential rater has given all this information to Fitch, you would be reluctant to switch to S&P even after a year when S&P comes back in the game.
S&P can still issue ratings for corporate bonds. They can also still service the residential and municipal bonds markets. And some say S&P might just shrug this off.
Maybe. Maybe not.
Dick Larkin is director of credit analysis for H.J. Sims. He says rating these kinds of securities was never really S&P's wheelhouse.
So it's not like these companies are going to get more business now that S&P has dropped out.
S&P said in a statement that it does not admit or deny any of the charges filed against it. The company also agrees to pay out $77 million, split between the SEC and the states of New York and Massachusetts. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, more ups than downs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The United Nations says that last year alone, 170,000 people fleeing war and persecution or simply seeking a better standard of living, and refugees from Syria, Iraq, and other countries in the region, crossed the Mediterranean Sea from Africa to Italy. Many paid human traffickers to smuggle them in, making the journey in small fishing boats and even rubber dinghies. More than 3,000 people have drowned along the way, but the smugglers have moved things up a gear. They've come up with a new business model. It's called the ghost ship route. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
The Ezzedine ship has just docked into port.
In a harbour on the southern coast of Italy, a BBC reporter witnesses the arrival of an ageing cargo ship.
Look at the people jammed up on the side of the ship there.
The battered old freighter, a former livestock carrier, was packed with migrants, most of them from war-torn Syria. Captain Francesco Perotti of the Italian Coast Guard said he towed the vessel ashore after the crew had apparently abandoned it on the high seas.
It's a very risky operation because we have a ship which is adrift, which has no command.
The ship had no lifeboats on board, the passengers no life vests. Ava Moncourt of the European Union's Border Agency says this was extremely hazardous, and not just for the migrants.
the crew apparently abandoned the ship that was on autopilot going full speed in the night in the Mediterranean. It's a danger to the people on board and danger also to the others who are at sea.
Three of these ghost ships carrying a total of more than 1,000 migrants have arrived in European waters in recent weeks. For the smugglers, this is a new business model which makes perfect commercial sense. Andrea De Nicola is a criminologist from the University of Trento and co-author of Confessions of a People Smuggler.
These are businessmen, opportunistic criminal businessmen, and this is a travel agency, the most ruthless travel agency on the planet. There's a huge profit involved.
First of all, forget about the cost of the ship, which the smugglers are abandoning. That, says David Osler of the Lloyd's List maritime newspaper, that cost is minimal.
Ships at the end of their working life are worth little more than the scrap value that they will yield if they are sailed to the breaking yards in Bangladesh or India.
Italian police claim that one of the ghost ships, the Ezzedine, cost the smugglers only $110,000. Now, says Joel Millman of the International Organization for Migration, consider what the smugglers are charging for the trip, up to $6,000 per passenger.
We estimated that one of the ships should have grossed revenues of $3 million. So if you do the math, you can see that there's millions to be made.
All the passengers so far seem likely to be offered asylum. So far, none have perished at sea. So far, the smugglers' new business model is paying off for the smugglers and their customers. But it does put many more people at risk. Another four ghost ships are reportedly ready to sail. More migrant lives are likely to be lost in the Mediterranean this winter. At the European desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Let me take a minute now to introduce you to a guy by the name of Jeff Green. He's a real estate investor, Mr. Green is. He is a billionaire. And he said the following to Bloomberg News today, that, and this is a quote, that America's lifestyle expectations are far too high and need to be adjusted so we have less things and a smaller, better existence, end of quote. Two things you got to know about that line. One, he said it at the World Economic Forum, the annual gathering of the ultra-rich and powerful in Davos, Switzerland, that's going on this week. Number two, he brought with him to Davos, in a private jet, his wife, his children, and two nannies. Odds are he wasn't trying, but Mr. Green has provided a shining example of the archetypical Davos man that one hears of about this time of year. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn has the biography.
The origins of Davos Man are murky. The first reference I could find was an editorial in The Economist from 1997, defending him as a paragon of global capitalism, bringing peace across boundaries of country and culture. Matthew Bishop was an editor at The Economist at the time, and I asked him to read from the final paragraph.
Some people find Davos Man hard to take. There's something uncultured about all the money grubbing and managerialism. But it's part of the beauty of Davos Man that, by and large, he does not give a fig for culture.
Because he cares about money, not culture or country, the editorial argued that Davos Man, the global capitalist elite, could bring the people of the world together. In the 18 years since...
It hasn't done that, and it has also exacerbated a sense of global inequality.
Shayla Benhabib, professor of philosophy and political science at Yale, says the forces that Davos Man represents have connected us through the internet and financial markets, but they've also pulled us apart.
I think this is one of the puzzles of our time.
One piece of the puzzle may be that Davos Man himself hasn't really evolved. I spoke to Felix Salmon, senior editor at Fusion at Davos, where he was surrounded by men in suits, some of whom paid tens of thousands of dollars for tickets. Salmon has been going to Davos for 7 or 8 years and says the crowd's basically the same.
It hasn't really changed since then. Rich people don't change that much, I don't think.
And as long as Davos Man is rich, he'll continue to be unpopular with those who can't afford a private jet to a Swiss ski resort. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Coming up...
The economy that I'm experiencing is on the cusp. It could go either way.
Checking in on your economy. But first, let's do the numbers. On Wall Street today, it was all about tomorrow, man. The Dow Industrials picked up 0.2%, 39 points, 17,554. The NASDAQ up 0.25%, 12 points, 46.67. The S&P 500 advanced 0.4%, 9 points, 2,032. Expectations that the ECB, the European Central Bank, will announce a new economic stimulus plan tomorrow, as we were telling you about. Well, that helped financial stocks as things go. Citigroup deposited 1% today. Bank of America did just about the same. Netflix streamed a 17% gain today after yesterday's strong earnings report. GoPro shot up more than 6%, that after being granted a patent for a camera design. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.87%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Health Committee holds a hearing on examining job-based health insurance and defining full-time work. It's the 42nd anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the historic Supreme Court ruling legalizing abortion. And get caffeinated for this. Starbucks releases quarterly earnings. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have in this country, according to the American Society for Civil Engineers, an infrastructure deficit of $3.6 trillion. That's what it would take over the next 5 years to get our roads and bridges and all the rest up to where they ought to be. There is also, though, a time deficit because building this stuff takes years. So, Pennsylvania has a plan to use prefab. From WHYY in Philadelphia, Marielle Segarra has more.
Building a bridge can be like watching paint dry. Or, in this case, concrete. Andrew Swank is the president of Swank Construction. His company's replacing a highway bridge in central Pennsylvania.
Right now, literally, we're standing in the middle of the Sotera Creek.
We're actually standing on a wooden footbridge over the creek. We're looking at the concrete walls that'll hold up the new bridge. It takes weeks for them to harden. Then the construction crew has to add the steel beams, pour concrete for the bridge surface, and wait for that to harden. Altogether,
it takes months to do, really.
Add in design and permitting, and it takes years. That's why Pennsylvania is speeding things up. Barry Shoak is a senior advisor to Governor Tom Wolf and the state's former Secretary of Transportation.
We expect that we're going to deliver 558 bridges in 3.5 years instead of what would have taken us 8 to 12 years under a traditional method.
The key is mass production. First, the engineers will put together a couple dozen standard cookie-cutter designs. They'll mix and match pieces of those standard designs when they look at each bridge site. Then, manufacturers will make some of the concrete bridge parts. They can't make everything in a factory, but they'll standardize whatever they can. Back at the creek, Andrew Swank says it'll only take a couple weeks to build bridges that have factory-made parts.
They'll have slotted ends that this piece will fit into this piece and key into this piece.
It's kind of like when you buy a bookshelf from IKEA.
I don't know if they'll have the terrible instructions that IKEA gives you, but yeah, they'll come to pieces that you lift up with the crane and slide into place and all of a sudden, you're going to have a bridge in a very short order.
Faster construction means less time the bridge is closed to traffic. And by the way, engineers say factory-built bridge parts are actually stronger than poured concrete because they're made at the exact right temperature, away from rain, snow, and weird weather. Pennsylvania isn't the first state to mass-produce its bridges. Missouri recently fixed and replaced more than 800 bridges in 3.5 years. Andy Herman is an engineer and former president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. He says states like Utah have also tried replacing bridges with prefabricated parts.
Florida, New York, Washington, and Virginia are also looking into it because they have so many deficient bridges that they have to fix, and they're trying to do it quickly.
Pennsylvania's going all in, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on its program. The state says this approach will be 20% cheaper than traditional methods. And who knows? Maybe the state will even start calling its bridges IKEA-style Swedish names, like Benjamin Franklin Bron. In Philadelphia, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Today in Things You Ate But Didn't Know It, seaweed. It can be found in toothpaste and yogurt and even beer. Seaweed is also an increasingly popular snack food all on its own, dried, salted a little bit, and packaged up real nice. Paul Dobbins is president of the first commercial kelp farm in the United States. It's called Ocean Approved. It's based up in Portland, Maine. Mr. Dobbins, it's good to have you with us.
Why, thank you, Kai. I'm happy to be here.
How exactly does one go about farming seaweed? Do you guys just sort of, you know, put some in the ocean and wait for it to grow?
You're not too far off from how it happens. We collect spores from mature seaweed in the fall. We grow those spores to tiny 1 millimeter long kelp plants, and then we put them out on long lines in the oceans, and then we just let it happen. Nature takes its course. Kelp is a cold water species that grows very well over the winter. In fact, it's just starting its significant growth period. It'll start growing at about 5.5 inches a day. And in the spring, we go out and we harvest it.
When you and your partner started this company back, what, 6, 7 something years ago now, did you have any idea that seaweed writ large was going to become the thing it has in American food?
We're surprised by how fast it's come along. We had spent a lot of time traveling in different parts of the world. We had a mussel aquaculture business prior to this one, and we saw the level of consumption of seaweed globally. Yeah. And realized it was only a matter of time before it started to be reintroduced into our country. Seaweed was eaten by our indigenous population before the colonists came along. Mm-hmm. And when my great-grandmother in Newfoundland was a little girl, why, they ate seaweed in the winter as a way to get your green nutrition at a time when there weren't any green plants available.
I mean, I got to tell you, I now go to Costco and I buy boxes of it and I pack it in my daughter's lunch every day. She comes home and says, Dad, I don't want those goldfishy things. I want a little thing of seaweed.
You know, our market, we have a significant market in the high schools and the private high schools and in colleges and universities, everywhere from the Harvard School of Public Health out to the University of Iowa. Kids are looking for nutritious alternatives, and it's an adventurous food. It's not something that they were served probably when they were real young.
That is true. It is an acquired taste, right?
Well, it is if you're eating the imported seaweeds. They're fairly strong in flavor. We've developed products that are very mild in flavor to take some of that angst that someone may have that it's going to take fishy right out of it.
Is this a family business for you? I mean, do you expect your kids to join you in the kelp and seaweed farming business?
Sure. All of us have young kids, and all of them work out on the farms. They'll come out with us. They've started since they were about 12, and we'll dress them up in survival suits and get them out to the farms and show them how we make our living.
How do you eat it?
I love it in the morning for breakfast. I have it with eggs and little Maine shrimp and some cheese.
What, like in an omelet or something?
Very similar. I just scramble up the eggs, throw some seaweed in there, throw some shrimp in there, and away we go.
Well, Mr. Dobbins, thanks very much for your time. That's Paul Dobbins. He's the president of Ocean Approved. It's a kelp farm up in Portland, Maine. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
So let's bring it full circle on that whole idea of middle-class economics. One of the things we've been doing the past couple of months is asking you what the economy feels like to you, because presidents can talk until they're blue in the face, but if people aren't feeling the growth, then it doesn't much matter, does it? Today, Matt Dolce from Williamsburg, Virginia, and an unfinished economic story.
The economy that I'm experiencing is on the cusp. It could go either way. I'm at the beginning of a promising career as a CPA, but there was a price for me to get where I am, and I still have doubts about whether that risk will pay off for me in the long run. I was brought up to believe in the value of education and hard work and that those investments pay off. So I decided several years ago, while working as a high school math teacher and not seeing any wage growth, that I would try for something more challenging and something that would support a better life for my family. I thought about how it would work for me to quit my job, to go back to school full-time. I trusted this bet would pay off in the long run. So despite the terrible job market in 2011, the fact that my wife also had left her job recently to finish her bachelor's degree, and the fact that we had four mouths to feed, I knew this was an opportunity I could not pass up, so I bought a master's degree. On one hand, I already know that it was a great decision, one of the best I've made in my life. I did earn my degree, I did get a job with one of the best accounting firms there is, and my wife is now self-employed in a business that she loves. So, my bet could pay off. But I wonder, is a smart, hard-working CPA in his early 30s supposed to have over $100,000 in student loans, $15,000 in credit card debt that accumulated while we were in school, nothing saved for the college of his 6- and 10-year-old children, virtually nothing saved for retirement? Is that how it's supposed to go? There really is a chance for a promising future for my family, in my career, with my skills, knowing that I'm willing to do the work. I know that, but I do not feel it. Not yet.
Not yet. Take a second. Share your story, how the economy feels to you. Tell us. We'll put you on the radio. Marketplace.org is the place you can do that.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
As final note on the way out today, in which we mark the passing of one Melvin Gordon. Mr. Gordon was the serving chief executive and chairman of the board of Tootsie Roll Industries. Yes, those Tootsie Rolls. He passed away yesterday at the age of 95. Remember, I said he was the serving chief executive. He will be succeeded by his wife of 65 years, who had been the president and COO of the company. Two things about this. Number one, who knew Tootsie Rolls were a publicly traded company? Come on, don't lie now. Also, Tootsie Roll Industries owns Charms and Blow Pop, Junior Mint, and Double Bubble, to name just a couple. All right, we are out of here. The Dow picked up 0.2%, 39 points. You did not know Tootsie Rolls was publicly traded. Come on. NASDAQ up 0.25%, 12 points. The S&P 500 up 0.4%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, and Charlton Thorpe. Engineer of the broadcast, I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.